Gulf Coast State College, the Lymphatic System and Immunity, Part 3. Remember, last time we mostly discussed our non-specific immune defenses. Today we're going to focus on our specific immunity. And I love that name, specific, because it tells you exactly what this is all about. This type of immunity is going to work against a specific organism, like a specific strain of a bacteria, a specific virus, or a specific parasite. Another good name that your book uses for this type of immunity is adaptive immunity, and adaptive implies that it can change, and sure enough, this type of immunity can adapt and work against organisms that may mutate or work against organisms that might not even exist yet. So either term is good. I prefer specific immunity. All my friends, when we're out on the weekend talking, we all call it specific immunity. So if you want to be in my club, call it specific immunity, but both are okay. The two basic characteristics of specific immunity are, number one, specificity, which we just talked about, and the second one is memory. That's right. This type of immunity can remember what it saw so that if you get that same type of infection again, you can come back bigger and badder and faster than ever before to attack it. Some other characteristics of specific immunity include self-recognition and self-tolerance. The names are really sort of self-explanatory. Self-recognition means our specific immunity has to be able to recognize us as us. It has to be able to recognize you as you. But that's not good enough. Once our cells and our specific immune system recognize us as us, they have to leave us alone. In other words, they better not attack us. That's called self-tolerance. The two basic types of specific immune responses that we'll talk about are cell-mediated immunity and antibody-mediated immunity. We'll talk about each of those one at a time, in that order. And even though it's easier to talk about them and learn about them in little compartments like we'll do today, what you have to understand is they really most often occur together and they work as a team. But it's just easier to learn them in separate little boxes. So let's go ahead, and on the next slide, I want to start off by looking at this figure from your book, and I sort of retitled this at the bottom, The Big Picture. So let's look at the big picture. Let's include a little bit of review to start with. You'll notice that the next slide in this slide bank has some fill in the blanks that I will fill in while I'm talking on this slide, because I like to look at the big picture. So remember where it all starts. Where does it all start? It all starts at the top here with our primary lymphatic organ called the red bone marrow. Remember there what happens. We have stem cells that divide and mature into fully mature B cells. And those B cells are fully trained fighting B cell soldiers. They're ready to be stationed to fight the fight throughout your body. And so the red bone marrow shoots those mature B cell soldiers to this big green structure, which you will notice really represents throughout the rest of this section our secondary lymphatic organs and tissues. You should remember what they are. Think to yourself right now, what are the secondary organs and tissues? Those are where we station the soldiers to fight the fight, and they include lymph nodes, MALT, and spleen. So that's what this big green structure represents on these slides. I might just refer to it in our discussion today as the big green bean, because I don't necessarily feel like saying secondary lymphatic organs and tissues 10 times over. Okay, what else was part of the big picture? In the red bone marrow, stem cells will also grow up into partially mature T cells that we call pre-T cells, and they get shot over to our other primary lymphatic organ called the thymus gland, and it's there that the pre-T cells grow up into full-fledged, fighting, mature T lymphocyte soldiers. Once we accomplish that mission, then we're allowed to station those in the big green bean. In other words, they get sent to the lymph nodes, MALT, and spleen. Okay, on this slide, also as part of the big picture, you'll see over here to the left, we have cell-mediated immunity, and we'll talk about this pathway first. Then we will talk about over here to your right, the antibody-mediated pathway. Please remember, those two pathways often occur at the same time. And the key thing to make a note of on this slide is right here in the middle, we have something called the helper T cell. And notice, the helper T cell is going to do just what it says it does. It's going to help. Notice, it's going to help both the cell-mediated pathway and it's going to help the antibody-mediated pathway. None of this is going to happen without the all-powerful helper T cell. It is the linchpin of the organization. Okay, so on this slide, really everything above my cursor here we've already done today, and really was a review from earlier discussions we've had. The only new thing on this slide is at the bottom. And I got to start out here by telling you, I guess I sort of told a little white lie earlier in the course. I said there are two main types of lymphocytes, B cells and T cells, and that's true, but it's not the whole story because there's actually four different kinds of T cells. So let's go ahead and break that down. First, we have a cell called a cytotoxic T cell. Know your root words. Cyto means cell, and toxic in this case means to kill. So these are killer T cells, and they're going to do exactly what they say they do. They're going to go out and kill the bad guys. I will often refer to these as killer T cells just because I really don't feel like saying cytotoxic T cells 10 million times today. Unfortunately for you, there's a synonym for cytotoxic T cells, and I'm not big on synonyms unless they're really used commonly in the real world, and this one is. So you should know that killer T cells are also known as CD8 cells. One of the corny memorization techniques I have to remember that from my pea brain is I take these two little O's in cytotoxic and I put them together, turn them on their side, and I make an 8. I know that seems silly, but I never forget the CD8 cell is the cytotoxic cell. Next cell is called a helper T cell. And let the name help you, because take a wild guess what a helper T cell is going to do. Yeah, it's going to help, and that's its main job. And there's a synonym for a helper T cell as well. They're also known as CD4 cells. To help me remember that, I play a little game here too, because if you take an H and sort of turn it on its side and upside down, you make the number 4. So that is kind of like an upside down lowercase h, I guess. So I never mix those up when I'm studying for the test. Third, there's a type of a T-cell called a memory T-cell. And a memory T-cell is going to do just what it says. It's going to remember stuff. It's going to remember maybe what infection or what cancer it saw before, so it could come back bigger and badder than ever if you ever see that same infection again, for example. The last cell on the list is one you're not responsible for this course. It's called a suppressor T-cell. I just throw it in there to be complete. For those of you who go further on into medicine, you'll learn the importance of the suppressor T-cell. Let's take a minute here for a clinical break, because some of you are probably thinking, oh boy, you know, that's a lot of definitions and this is Trivial Pursuit, and I'll never see this stuff again in my whole life. Well, let me give an example of how you will. Of course, there are patients you will see who are infected with the HIV virus, who can then develop AIDS, of course. And one of the blood tests you will see come back on the chart in your AIDS patients is something called a CD4 to CD8 ratio. In a normal person, that ratio is 1 or greater. And you don't have to remember this. I'm just telling you this to emphasize the importance of what we're learning here. Anyway, in an AIDS patient, the HIV virus unfortunately destroys the CD4 cells. It eats helper cells for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, so to speak. So, in an AIDS patient, that CD4 to CD8 ratio will drop below 1. Let's go ahead and get some other basic definitions now. We really can't tell the story of immunity and understand the pathways unless we have some basic definitions in our armamentarium. So let's get through these definitions before we get to the meat. First, an antigen, typically abbreviated AG. An antigen was named because an antigen is anything that could generate an immune response. So antigens are substances that provoke an immune response. Usually, they are large proteins. Examples of foreign antigens include bacteria, any type of microbe, parts of microbes, toxins from bacteria, pollen, transplanted organs, and something I hope you don't do is place incompatible blood cells into somebody. Yeah, that would be a piece of protein, a foreign antigen, that doesn't belong in someone that would cause some problems for sure. So please don't do that. When I went to school, that's pretty much all we knew. We just called these foreign proteins that don't belong in us antigens. But of course, they learned a lot more since I went to school. And somebody, I guess they had a really good microscope or something, when they looked at this big protein antigen, they saw these little funny colored shaped things on the top. And they gave a name to them, of course, because we have to name everything in anatomy. And they called these little pieces of protein poking off the big one epitopes. I like that name because it sounds like, and it means, on the top. And these little pieces on the top, called epitopes, are the small parts of the antigen that actually trigger the immune response. So if you were asked on a test what specifically triggers the immune response and you have a multiple choice list, please pick epitope. Okay, so while you're making notes on this slide, some of you might be thinking, well, okay, antigen, yeah, I'll remember this and study it, but I'll never see that again in my real life. But you will, and here's one example that you may have heard of. There's something called a PSA. You'll measure it in the blood of your male patients. It stands for prostate-specific antigen. And it's a piece of protein that you can measure in the blood. And if a man has prostate cancer, he'll make more of that and release it into his blood. And it is a potential sign that he may have a prostate cancer. So yes, antigens are real and you'll even measure them. Let's go ahead and do another basic definition. We must understand what an antigen receptor is. And I love the name. Often in anatomy, the name tells you so much. An antigen receptor is something that could recognize and receive an antigen. You're going to have to make some notes here because it's nowhere else in the slides. I want you to know three key things about antigen receptors. Number one, write down that these are usually proteins as well. Number two, where do you see them? Well, over here I drew a picture to give you a clue. Here is from ANP1, a picture of a lymphocyte, and sure enough, you see these proteins called antigen receptors on the surfaces of B lymphocytes and T lymphocytes. Conveniently, for my pea brain, the ones on B cells are called B cell receptors, and the ones on T cells are called T cell receptors. You can kind of picture it like this. Here's your lymphocyte with a cell membrane, of course. Down here, I blew up a big cell membrane, and you learned about all the proteins that sort of stud your cell membrane. Well, some of those proteins on your lymphocytes indeed are these receptors that are meant and designed to match up with foreign antigens that they may encounter in the future. The third thing I want you to know is this, and it's just an amazing fact to me. When your B cells and your T cells are produced very early on in life, and when they're stationed throughout your body, they already are born with receptors on their surface with the ability to recognize about 1 billion different things, 1 billion different foreign invaders, things that maybe don't even exist yet, bacteria or viruses that maybe haven't even come into our world yet, receptors for synthetic materials that haven't even been invented yet. Truly amazing to me. How can it be that our B cells and T cells are sort of born ready to recognize 1 billion different foreign antigens, some of which that don't even exist yet? And the answer is through the magic of something I want you to write down called genetic recombination. Genetic recombination. Remember from ANP1, we roughly have 30,000 genes. And you might think to yourself, how can 30,000 genes code for a billion different protein receptors? And it's kind of like this, and I'll use your book's example. If I have a deck of 52 cards, and I try to deal out, let's say, sets of three from that deck of 52 cards, I can surely deal out more than just 52 different sets of three cards to you, couldn't I? Kind of like by shuffling things over and over again. And that's kind of what genetic recombination is doing. By shuffling things around and recombining things, our genes can code for 1 billion different protein antigen receptors. And these specific antigen receptors are designed to physically match up with the antigens, the foreign antigens that they may encounter someday. And it's kind of like a lock and key hookup. That's a good way to visualize this concept. And we'll have some photographs or some figures of that coming up shortly. The next term we have to understand and define is something called major histocompatibility complex antigens. Yikes, that's a big word. Thank goodness when I'm out on the weekends with my friends, we all just call it MHC. That's certainly much simpler to say. And it kind of goes like this. All of our body cells on their surface have surface protein markers called MHC. And these are really our self-antigens. In other words, down here I have a picture of a cell. Let's say this is a typical body cell. And then we pull out the cell membrane and blow it up. And again, remember there's tons of proteins studding the surface of that cell membrane. Well, one of the things that our genes do every day as part of their regular activity is they code for a protein that identifies us. And they plunk that identifying protein on our cell surface so that we could identify us as us and you as you. I think of them as our me markers. MHC are our me markers. MHC is you and me. They are also called self-antigens. It's kind of like a uniform on a football team. You could tell who's on your team and who's not on your team by the uniform. And that's sort of what these MHC markers are all about. Fortunately for my pea brain, there's only two types of MHC antigens. There's MHC1 and MHC2. Let's talk about MHC1 first. MHC1 is the main one. It's built into all cell membranes of all body cells except one, the red blood cell. MHC2 appears on the surface of cells called antigen-presenting cells, or APCs for short. But the name is a good name. Antigen-presenting cells do exactly what they say they're going to do. They're going to present foreign antigens to other cells. So that's a great name. And I keep it simple for our course and for myself too. MHC2, you will find on the surface of two cells, the only two APCs I want you to know for our course, and they include macrophages and dendritic cells. And look where they're located. APCs, macrophages, and dendritic cells. They're located in the skin, in mucous membranes, in the lymphatic tissues we've talked about. And if I were you, I'd just think about the big picture here and write it down, because to me, that says they're located everywhere. And they are. They're everywhere, and it's a great thing to have those cells all throughout the body. So in summary, make it easy on yourself. MHC1, it's the main one. It's on all body cells except one, which is the red blood cell. MHC2 is only on two cells, macrophages and dendritic cells. Okay, so you're studying the slide and you're saying, okay, I could learn that, but this really sounds pretty trivial to me and I'll never see this again in my life. Well, you will, and I'll give you an example. You've heard about tissue transplants, and let's say I want to give my left kidney to my brother. And they want to see if, you know, we're a match. What do you think they might want to match? Well, it's right on this slide. They're going to want to match our MHC antigens. They're going to look at our me markers. And the closer they are together, the less likely there's going to be a rejection of the organ. So, yes, this is real and this is important stuff. I just threw this picture in there just to emphasize a good, I think, analogy, a good example. MHC is you and me. It's our me markers. It's our uniforms. It lets us identify us versus the bad guys. This slide goes into a little bit more detail, but please don't make it harder than it is. There's some writing on this slide. I'm going to try to explain it with an example and simplify it. So let's go ahead and go through this. So first, functions of MHC antigens. Bullet point number one in red, we already really addressed. It allows our immune system to recognize self versus non-self, me versus you, us versus them. So that what, and this is the important thing, so that if they become altered by some foreign invader, a foreign antigen, that will be a signal to the immune system that something's wrong that needs to be dealt with. No better way than to do it by example. First, let me give an example for MHC1. Remember, this is the main one on all body cells except one. So if I'm a body cell, picture yourself as a body cell. And I picture myself as a body cell, and I walk around, and I take my hand, and I just put my index finger, and I stick it above my head. So I'm walking around with my finger, my number one finger, on top of my head, and I picture that as my MHC1 marker. So if I'm a normal body cell, and I'm okay, nothing's wrong with me, that's the way I'm walking around, and that's the way I look. But if a bug, if a virus gets inside me, or if a cancer affects me, what happens? Well, when a virus gets in you or a cancer affects the body cell, essentially what it does is it hijacks your genetic machinery. And it sort of alters your genetic code so that your genes will no longer make that normal number one MHC marker that maybe you're holding on your head now. It will alter it. It will deform it. Maybe it will look like a curly Q or a curve rather than a straight number one. So if that virus hijacks your genetic machinery, it hijacks your genetic code, and it makes an altered MHC1 that doesn't look like you anymore. So you no longer walk around the room with the number one on your head. Maybe now you're walking around the room with a little curved finger, a little curly Q on your head. And now your immune system can look at that and say, hey, that doesn't look like you anymore. It looks like something different. And maybe I should do something about it. And sure enough, we'll see that this is the main thing that's involved in cell-mediated immunity. Again, just as a summary and a quick memorization technique, MHC1 on all body cells except one. It's the main one, and it is involved only in one type of immunity, cell-mediated immunity. Next, I'm going to give an example for MHC2, but before I do that, on the top of this slide, I put, this is a nice place to begin to tell the story of specific immunity. I like to tell this as sort of one continuous story. If you look in your book here, it could be kind of confusing. Your book really doesn't put it all together. I think the main thing that they leave out is you really have to think of all the following slides that we talk about and the processes as all happening at about the same time and at about the same place. And if you think of it that way, I think you could tie it together and understand it better. So what I ask students to do is I want you to maybe think of yourself, make yourself real small. I want you to sit down on the back of your tongue And I want you to stare at the back of your throat where there's, of course, mucous membranes. There's tonsils back there, which are part of your malt tissue, of course. And I want you to pretend you're watching a movie in the back of your throat. And the movie is, we're going to be an infected throat. So let's run through all these pathways being an infected throat. So here we go. Okay, for MHC2, here's the deal. If I'm an APC, let's say like over here, let's be a macrophage because that's really the main one. There's a macrophage. If I'm a macrophage, my genetic machinery, as part of its normal daily activities, if everything is okay, on my surface, I put one of my me markers. Me marker number 2. Remember, MHC2. And what I do is I just take my hand again, and on the top of my head, I just put 2 fingers up so it looks like I have bunny ears on top of my head. So I got those 2 green things, I guess like bunny ears, that's my MHC2 on the top of my head. If everything's going fine and I'm not disturbed in any way, that's how I'm supposed to look. But let's say, as a macrophage now, I'm swimming around in the back of my throat tissue, in the body fluids, like swimming around in a swimming pool. And then in the swimming pool, I encounter something that doesn't belong. And here it is here, this purple floaty. So we encounter a floaty in the swimming pool. And if I'm a macrophage swimming around in the swimming pool and I found a floaty, what's my job as a macrophage if I find that? Well, my job is to gobble that thing up because I'm a Pac-Man cell. So let me summarize this here and tell you what you need to know. The short story is the macrophage gobbles up this purple pill, gobbles up that foreign antigen floaty, and it takes pieces of that floaty, little pieces of that purple protein, and it mixes it with itself. So now we have the good green bunny ears now mixed with a bad piece of the purple floaty. So now it takes that combination deal and plunks that on its surface. So no longer do I have the good green bunny ears plunked on my surface. I have the bunny ears along with that purple piece of floaty that doesn't belong. So I'm altered. I look different. I know I'm different. I know I have a problem. I know I found something, and I know I need help. After all, I'm just one macrophage. I found one bug floating in the swimming pool in the back of my throat. But chances are, there's tons of bacteria, whatever, floating back there and elsewhere. So I know I need help. So what happens next? And this is key. The macrophage migrates. In other words, it moves, it swims over to some nearby, next door, secondary lymphatic tissue. In this case, the tonsils, which are right next door. And in the tonsil tissue, what it's looking for to get help is simply a helper T cell. So you go to get help from the helper T cell. On the next slide, I put the big picture up again to kind of remind you where we are. So here we are. We're in the tonsil in the back of the throat. And we have an infected throat. And we're bringing that piece of floaty, that foreign antigen, to get help. And we're bringing it to the helper T cell that is inside the tonsil. So we're going to take this pathway of the helper T cell story, and we're going to take it out of the tonsil, and we're going to put it on the next slide and blow it up and talk about it. And here it comes. So, here is at the top, here's the macrophage. The macrophage is carrying that purple piece of floaty, the piece of foreign altered antigen that doesn't belong and is not normal. It brings it into the tonsil and finds a helper T cell, remember, also called a CD4 cell. And chances are, there's a helper T cell sitting in your tonsil in an inactive state, just waiting for the day to see that bug. Remember when we talked about genetic recombination, that helper T cell is sitting back there, born ready for the day when it was going to see that bug. So what happens? The macrophage brings it that foreign antigen. The helper T cell has the beautiful matching lock and key hookup, and it says, beautiful. Well, I'm a helper T cell. I finally met up with something I was designed to hook up with. I'm pretty sure I'm supposed to do something. I'm pretty sure I'm supposed to help, but I want to be doubly sure. It wants a second signal. As you'll see in all the up-and-coming slides, there's always a second signal. It helps to have a system of checks and balances in the immune system, or else the immune system would make a lot of mistakes. So what's the second signal that the inactive helper T cell is waiting for? It's waiting for something called co-stimulation. Co-stimulation is the second signal, kind of like a co-pilot is a second pilot. And co-stimulation is provided with a chemical called interleukin. The interleukin, in this case, comes from the macrophage. The interleukin is sort of like a special sauce, a special squirt of juice that's sent over and splashed onto the helper T cell, and the macrophage says, here it comes, I've got your special secret handshake, here's your second signal you've been waiting for. And once that helper T cell gets the second signal, it says, okay, now I know I'm ready to activate. And once it gets activated, it gets all juiced up and it duplicates or proliferates into thousands and thousands of active helper T cells that are actively ready to go out and help. And it also duplicates into a second different clone of cells called memory helper T cells that are set off to the side just in case you see that same infection again, so you can come back bigger and better and faster than ever before to attack it. Once we have active helper T cells, they are ready to actively help other cells. Which other cells? Well, all other cells that we talked about, including killer T cells for cell-mediated immunity and B cells for antibody-mediated immunity. Let's go back to the big picture again. Remember what we just did. I've got an expanding red rectangle going around the active helper T cells, thousands of them that are now ready to actively help all other cells in the immune system. The killer T cells on one side that will do first, and then the B cells on the other side of the diagram that will do second. So first, let's talk about the pathway off to the left side called cell-mediated immunity. And I love the term cell-mediated immunity because the short story is, in cell-mediated immunity, killer T cells are going to go out and hunt down and kill other body cells that have already been infected or affected from within. Cells killing other cells that have already been infected. Let's go ahead and take a look at the long story. That was the short story. And again, what you have to picture is this is all happening at about the same time and about the same place. You're sitting on the back of the tongue. You're looking at the throat infection. You're looking at the tonsil tissue back there. And this diagram off to your left is just sort of a magnified view of what we just pulled out of the big green bean diagram on the other picture. So here's the story. You could look at the words, but let me tell the story. Chances are, in the back of the throat, we already have an infected body cell. So my cursor's pointing to an infected body cell. And instead of having a normal me marker number one, instead of having that MHC1 index finger on the top of its head, maybe it's got a deformed, curved, like a curlicue protein marker instead. And chances are, right next door, there is a killer T cell in an inactive state, just sitting there, born ready because of genetic recombination with the antigen receptor on its surface, ready to match up in a perfect lock and key hookup. So that killer T cell just waiting, born ready for the day to see that bad body cell. And once you have that lock and key hookup, the killer cell says, well, I recognize you, I hooked up with you, I'm pretty sure I'm supposed to kill you. But I want to be doubly sure, because we don't want to go out in the body killing things willy-nilly by mistake. So what does the inactive killer T cell wait for? The same thing we just talked about. The second signal, the co-stimulation, which is always with a chemical called interleukin. I like that word interleukin because inter means between and leuk means white. And this is a chemical signal essentially in between white cells. Where does the interleukin come from in this case? Well, it comes from the all-important helper T cell. Remember, the helper T cell in the last frame of the movies already saw the bad guy. The helper T cell says, no problem. You saw the bad guy. I already saw the bad guy, and I'm ready to help you. I'll give you the super secret handshake. I'll give you a squirt of the special sauce. Here comes the juice called interleukin. I'll lay it on you. And once that killer T cell gets the second signal, then it's ready to become activated. And it's really repetitive. It's the same story again. Once you activate the killer T cell, it duplicates into a clone of thousands and thousands of active killer T cells that are ready to actively go out and hunt down and kill any bad body cells. And off to the side, it makes a different clone of thousands of cells called memory killer T cells that again are ready to come back bigger and badder and faster than ever before if you ever have that same infection, for example. While you're making notes, I want to talk about the importance of this second signal. It really is great to have this system of checks and balances. Just like with a co-pilot, it's the plane is safer with a second pilot. Your immune system is safer with a second signal called co-stimulation. If we didn't have this system of checks and balances, our immune system might go off willy-nilly killing things or attacking things it's not supposed to be doing. And maybe we would have a lot more of what we call autoimmune diseases if we didn't have this setup. Maybe many more of us would have autoimmune diseases where we attack ourselves, like rheumatoid arthritis or lupus or other autoimmune diseases. I also want to emphasize this concept of memory. I did a little bit of research on how long our memory cells can live, and I don't believe everything I read on the internet, but I read someplace that our memory T cells or memory cells in general can live up to 90 years I'm not sure if that's a number I would quote if I were you, but let's say they can sure live a long time. Memory cells can hang out for decades, and it's great to have that. While you're thinking about this slide and making some notes, I want to give you another example that your book uses for co-stimulation. Your book gives the example of a car. If you put the key into the ignition, that's like the antigen and antigen receptor hookup. That's sort of the first signal. But are things moving yet? Is your car driving yet? And the answer is no. You got to give it the second signal. The second signal, your book says, is you shift your transmission into drive. That's the co-stimulation. That's where we get things moving. So that's a pretty good example from your book, so I guess I'll steal that. Let me ask you now a critical thinking question based on some of this stuff. Have you ever experienced memory? And I don't mean memory for a test. I mean immunological memory. Think about this. Those of you who live in a household with several members in the house, sometimes someone will get an infection, then it will spread to the next person and the next person, and everyone gets sick. And then sometimes the infection will come around again. But did you ever notice if the infection goes around the house for the second time, if you even catch it, it's a lot less severe, and it lasts a much shorter amount of time. That's because of the memory cells we're talking about that help to knock it back faster. Let me give you another example of how this applies to the real world. You may have heard of a test, a TB test, called a PPD test. That's a test we have to get if we work in the hospital. You will give the test to patients to try to see if they've ever been exposed to TB. And here's the concept of the test. PPD stands for purified protein derivative. In English, it's a piece of protein designed to look like TB. It's not TB. It's a protein designed to imitate TB, and you inject it under the patient's skin. Of course, you really don't want to give them real TB. That would be considered poor form, of course. But if the patient ever had exposure to TB in the past, then their immune system was probably fired up in the past and remembers that. So when you inject this fake piece of protein that looks like TB under the person's skin, after a few days, their immune system reacts to it, and they get this big red sort of swollen area on their arm, and you'll be able to tell whether or not they've been exposed to TB, all based on some of these concepts that we're talking about. This next slide, if I were you, I would title it in sort of simple layman's terms. All this slide says is, how do killer T cells kill? So let's talk about it. Once we activate a killer T cell soldier, what it does is it checks all your body cells, so to speak. I sort of take my hand and I make take my two fingers and I grab my arm and I sort of just see if it matches up on my arm, and I picture this as a killer T cell checking my arm cells, and I look at myself and I say, okay, me, 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 me. Then if I find something that looks deformed, I say, not me. And if I find a not me, I kill it. So what happens is your killer T cells look at your throat. For this example, we're an infected throat. It goes throughout your throat, checking me, 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 me versus not me. And once it finds a bad body cell that's got the deformed marker, it kills it. Not only that, look what this slide says. After it clears out your throat, T cells move. T cells travel. Please remember that. T cell with a T, travel with a T. T cells travel, because you might have even recognized this. Sometimes you have a sore throat, but you also feel kind of sick all over sometimes. Sometimes you got a runny nose, maybe you got a pink eye, maybe you got a little bit of diarrhea. In other words, maybe the virus infected body cells somewhere else besides your throat. So T-cell travel. And they're checking for the proper me marker. And if they find something that looks like not me, they're going to hook up with it in a lock and key hookup. And they're going to do a cell-to-cell attack. And that's why they call it cell-mediated immunity. So on the figure, here we have an active killer T-cell. It may be traveled and found another infected body cell. It did the lock and key hookup, and it's already juiced up, so it's ready to kill. How do killer T cells kill? I only want you to know two ways. I'm keeping it simple for our course. One way killer T cells kill is they release a chemical called perforin. And I love the term perforin because it kind of sounds like, well, perforate. And that's exactly what it's going to do. Perforin is going to land on that infected body cell and it's going to pop it open. Now, what's the other thing killer T cells do? I think of it this way. If I'm going to pop this bad body cell, if I'm going to lay down a grenade and I'm going to blow it up to smithereens, well, next we got to kind of come in and do cleanup duty, don't we? So the next beautiful thing that the killer T cell does, it makes a chemical called gamma interferon. I know we already talked about interferon before, but there's different kinds of interferon. This one, I like it. It's called gamma interferon with a G. And when I think G, I think go. And gamma interferon says, go get some phagocytes. In other words, let's call in some Pac-Man cells to gobble up all this debris we're left with after we laid down the perforin. The last bullet point on this slide is really just a summary, but it's key. Cell-mediated immunity is cells killing other body cells that have already been infected or affected from within. This is a cell-to-cell attack where we target bad body cells. In other words, the virus already got in me. The cancer already has affected me as a body cell. Or in the case of a tissue transplant, if I put my tissue cell from my kidney inside my brother, that kidney tissue cell is different from him from within. The me number one, MHC1, looks different. Cell to cell attack. This is an embedded animation. Sometimes these links that your book provides work well. Sometimes they don't. Links can be finicky. If it works, go ahead and maybe plow your way through and you might find this animation useful. Here we are back to the big picture. So let's sort of summarize things. Remember, in this movie, we're watching this infected throat. The first thing we did, of course, is we jacked up the all-important helper cells. Again, it's the thing that hooks everything together. We already talked about cell-mediated immunity off to the left, and now we're ready to finish off with antibody-mediated immunity. The short story is, and really most of what you need to know is, in antibody-mediated immunity, B cells are going to turn into a brand new cell called plasma cells, and the plasma cells are going to pump out millions of these red-looking things called antibodies, and the antibodies are going to cruise through your body fluids looking for the bugs in your body fluids before they get inside your cells. That's key stuff. Before we proceed with that pathway, let me ask you a mini critical thinking question that I often ask on the test. Here we go. So I'll tell you on the test, the AIDS virus destroys helper cells. It eats CD4 cells for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So, on the test, I can ask you, in such a patient, what type of immunity may be affected? Cell-mediated only, antibody-mediated only, or both? And I hope you instantly said both, because it's the helper cell that hooks it all together. Unfortunately, the AIDS virus is really good at what it does. It destroys your immune system by lopping off the head of the snake. If you destroy those helper cells, you can't help this pathway, you can't help this pathway, and that's why those patients are in such trouble. For this slide about antibody-mediated immunity, again, what we have here, this figure, this is a diagram that really is just pulled out of the right side of that big green beam from the big picture. And before I describe it, again, you have to think about this as all happening at about the same time and about the same place, because it usually is. So we're still staring at that movie, that infected throat, that tonsil that you're looking at. So here's the deal. In the tonsil, there is sitting a B cell in an inactive state. And that B cell was born ready with an antigen receptor on its surface, just waiting for the day to see that bug come by. And here's how you have to think of B cells. B cells be still. In other words, they just sit there in the body fluids, in your throat tissue, and they're just looking for the bugs to come swimming by in the body fluids. And that B cell, when it sees that bug come swimming by, it has the receptor to match up with that antigen and kind of snatch that bug right out of the body fluid. Once it snatches that bug out of the body fluid, it says, okay, I have the antigen receptor hookup, and I'm pretty sure I'm supposed to do something. But once again, I want to be doubly sure so I don't make a mistake. So what does it wait for? It waits for the second signal. It waits for co-stimulation with interleukin. Once again, the helper T cell already saw the bug. It's ready to give the second signal. It says, no problem. You saw the bug. I already saw the bug. I got the special secret juice. Here comes a squirt of interleukin. I lay it right on you. And once you give it the second signal, it's ready to activate. And what does the B cell do? There are some similarities, but a couple of differences. So here we go. Once you activate the B cell, what does it do? It duplicates into two different groups of cells. Number one, it duplicates into thousands and thousands of brand new different cells called plasma cells. Plasma cells are not B cells. They are a brand new cell that came from the B cell. It's sort of like going from a caterpillar to a butterfly. The other thing the B cell will do is it will duplicate and multiply into a clone of thousands and thousands of memory B cells, tucked off to the side as always, just in case you have that same infection another day. Then, look, it's the plasma cells that will produce and release hundreds of millions of specific antibodies. Antibodies shown here in red that are specific to that infection, that specific bug that launched off the whole process. And kind of fascinating to me that those plasma cells make hundreds of millions of antibodies per day for several days. Then what happens? This slide, if I were you, I'd retitle it again in layman's terms. This says, how do antibodies do their job? How do antibodies, you know, kill and get rid of the foreign invaders? Look what this says. It says, the antibodies enter the circulation. Not the B cells, B cells be still, okay? It's the antibodies that enter the circulation. And now you know you have two different kinds of circulation. You have a lymph circulation and you have a blood circulation, and the antibodies enter both of those. They cruise throughout your body fluids looking for that specific foreign invader in your body fluids. Then, what do the antibodies do when they find them? Picture these little red kind of Y-shaped deals. I kind of be the antibody. I like to be the antibody or be the spleen. You know, it just helps me visualize these things and remember them better. So be the antibody here. And in this case, I'll be that red antibody swimming through the body fluids, and I'll match up to that specific bug I'm designed to hook up with, and I'll grab onto it. I'll neutralize it. I'll immobilize it. And if I grab onto a bug, if I immobilize it, that bug can't do much. I mean, if you hold an organism still, there's not much it can do to harm you. So that's one way antibody does its job. The second way antibody does its job is when it grabs onto that bug, it starts to call on some of our old friends. It's kind of like a red flag. And it will activate complement. And you remember the way complement can kill bugs. And then thirdly, when that red antibody grabs onto that bug, and again serves like kind of a red flag to your immune system, it calls on for some reinforcements, and it calls on your phagocytes, and the phagocytes come on in and they do their Pac-Man job and gobble up the bugs. So three ways that antibodies help to eliminate any foreign invaders. The last bullet point on this slide is really a summary of what we just said. And it's just so key. Antibody-mediated immunity is mostly effective against extracellular bugs or any foreign antigens, foreign proteins, that are outside your cells, in your body fluids. Antibodies cruise your body fluids and look for the bad guys before they get inside your cells. A student one day told me something I'm going to steal from him. He said, I remember this easy. I just say antibody body fluid, and it really just helps me remember the main deal. So I'll take that from him. That's a good little saying. Okay, so what's the big picture? I mean, you shouldn't just be memorizing these pathways. You should be thinking about the big picture. Think of the beauty of the immune system. So here's my example. Here we are, we watched a movie of this infected throat and how your body deals with it. Let's say you only had cell-mediated immunity. Cells killing other body cells that have already been infected. Would that really be good enough? Do you think you would ever really get completely well? Think about it. Chances are what? Chances are there are some bugs floating around somewhere else in your body fluids, and if you didn't have a way to clean out your body fluids, what would happen? You would keep reinfecting yourself over and over again, and you never get well. So what a beautiful design. We have killer T cells killing bad body cells that have already been infected. Then we got antibodies cruising your body fluids, killing the bugs outside your cells before they have a chance to reinfect you. What a gorgeous system. Let me also hit on another key point, another big picture item. If you've been paying attention to this, every step of the way we had co-stimulation, and it was always with a chemical called interleukin. So if you're really taking this course to help people, maybe you could think of something to do to help people with interleukin. And sure enough, someone who took this course said, you know what? If there's someone who's having a problem with an infection or maybe a cancer, maybe I could jack up their immune system by injecting them with interleukin. And yep, they're doing it. They tried it in AIDS. That would be the first thing that would come to my mind. Unfortunately, it didn't really work that well. But they have had success in people with melanoma and kidney cancer. Some of those patients have done better with those cancers by getting injections of interleukin. So, yes, this is real stuff. Here's another embedded animation. If the link's working, check that out and maybe get some good visuals on that. The links, again, they're finicky. We need to know a little bit more. After all, we are ANP2, so we got to know a little bit more detail about antibody structure. And I'll tell you the bullet points you need to know on this slide. And I know what's important because, after all, I make the tests. Key things to circle on this slide. Number one, antibodies are often called immunoglobulins, typically abbreviated IG. And yes, in the hospital, you will inject people with antibodies, but on the jar, it's going to say immunoglobulin. Number two thing to circle on this slide. Most antibodies are types of proteins. Okay, most of them have four chains, but not all of them. The key is, for me, I want you to know that they're mostly, that these are proteins. Another key thing is that they have a hinge region, like a T or a Y shape. And again, I be the antibody, and I stand here with my arms up, and I make a Y shape. And the beauty of that design is it serves a purpose. You can picture, if you're floating around like a Y-shaped antibody, that gives you a little flexibility to grab on to the bugs and the body fluids. The really key point on this slide is it's at the tips that I'll circle here on this Y-shaped antibody that are the variable regions. In other words, these are the regions that form the very specific antigen binding sites that are specific just to that bug they were designed to meet up with. And the way I kind of remember this is I stand and hold my arms up like a Y, and at the tips of my fingers, of course, are fingerprints, and my fingerprints are what make me me. They're very specific just to me, and it's those fingertips, it's those tips of the antibodies that make them specific just to that bacteria they were designed to attack. There are five different classes of immunoglobulins. They are called IgG, IgA, IgM, IgE, and IgD. I know you've got a lot to remember, but I put it up that way on purpose because I spelled a word. It spells gamed, doesn't it? So that makes it easy to remember the five classes of antibodies. On the next slide, we'll talk just a very little bit about what those different classes do. Different classes of antibodies sort of have different functions or missions. Let's go ahead and talk about them. IgM, if I ask you with the M, is the main one to respond first when a patient has the initial exposure to the antigen, to the infection. So I just remember IgM with an M is the main one with an M to respond first. IgG with a G, I remember it this way. You get gobs of it. In other words, your body makes lots of IgG. You get gobs of it the second go around. In other words, if you get syphilis, the first time you get syphilis, it's IgM that will appear first on a blood test. If your patient gets syphilis a second time, it's actually IgG that will appear first and in very large amounts on a blood test. And IgG is the only one to get across the placenta. So again, I let the G help me. IgG, you get gobs of it the second go around, and it's the only one to get across the placenta. IgA with an A is in almost all body fluids. including breast milk, saliva, tears, gastrointestinal secretions. So just think A for almost all body fluids. Finally, IgE is involved in allergy. And that's just my simple pea brain techniques of remembering those. Yes, I left IgD off of here. Don't worry about it. This last slide is just for you. It's beyond the scope of our course. It's really for an upper level course. But if you go further into healthcare, you will see that if you understand these concepts we're talking about, if you're trying to find out if someone has toxoplasmosis or Lyme disease or syphilis, you can do blood tests and you could find out if it's their first exposure, if it's their second exposure, or maybe how long they've had the disease by knowing these response curves of the different antibody classes we've talked about. And yes, this has clinical application. What about vaccinations? When you vaccinate someone, what do? Well, you give them a piece of protein that looks like the infection, or a dead or an inactive form of the organism. Of course, you don't really want to give them the live organism. That, again, would be considered poor form. So you give them a piece of protein that looks like the bug. And what happens is your immune system gets faked out. It thinks it has the infection, and it goes through all those pathways that we just talked about, tucks thousands of memory cells off to the side, so that if you ever really do get exposed to the real bug, well, maybe you won't get infected at all, or if you do, hopefully it'll be a much milder or shorter course. One more application I'll give you on this slide. What if someone comes to you in the ER and they have rabies or they have tetanus? I mean, you've got no time, really, you know, to wait for the immune system to fire up because they'll be dead by then. So you will see, you will have jars, vials of things called tetanus immunoglobulin. That'll be right on the label on the jar. In other words, there's a jar full of antibodies already made to tetanus that you could inject them with to save their life. So yes, I know this is a lot of stuff. I know it's complicated, but it's the real deal.